X-29, number 7B.
Love, truth, and life, we have seen, are the overall tones of the first three parts. In this fourth part, they appear again, but this time we have love, truth, and life combined with spirit, because what is being emphasized now is their universal reflection as spiritual facts. Hence, the text speaks first about love and spirit, restful action, universally reflected. Second, about truth and spirit, the Christ truth reflected in the truth about everything. Third, about life and spirit, the eternal life reflected in sinless understanding. In this connection, I should like to draw your attention to another pertinent point. At the beginning of this fourth part, Mrs. Eddy makes the interesting statement, "The procuring cause and foundation of all sickness is fear, ignorance, or sin." Science and Health 4:11, 20-21. So fear, ignorance, or sin lie at the bottom of all disease. If we look at the text of Mental Treatment Illustrated, we shall find that Mrs. Eddy deals with fear through love and spirit, with ignorance through truth and spirit, and with sin as the cause of death through life and spirit, the three main combinations I mentioned before. The scientific exactness of Mrs. Eddy's revelation and the structure of her presentation are really wonderful beyond words. Let us quickly run through the subjects of this fourth part. The first main tone is that of love and spirit, and there are two distinct subjects depicting it. Love is here presented as omnipotence and as the ultimatum to fear, the one big cause of disease. As spirit, divine love reflects itself in the thought of the patient and frees him from timidity, fear, dread, and agony, bestowing on him the graces of love, which are peace, rest, calmness, and quietude. As Mrs. Eddy shows, treatment starts with, "Be not afraid," and further she says that if you succeed in wholly removing the fear, your patient is healed. Science and Health 4:11, 32-1. So the allaying of fear is the main point here. The first subject teaches us that love's fulfillment of its own reflection operates through mental and spiritual science, mind. Mental practice operates by pleading and arguing mentally for the truth, and this mental plea serves to allay the fear of the patient. But as we find here, arguments are only necessary so long as the practitioner is not perfectly attuned to spiritual science. Mental argument must finally give place to mind's control over the body, or, to put it differently, healing by right thinking must finally give place to spiritual science. Then, in the second subject, we learn that love's reflection is real and ordered, spirit. Once the patient's thought is freed from fear, once it has become calm, quiet, restful, and peaceful, he reflects the natural order of being. Fear, on the other hand, brings disorder. Fear is an unnatural state of mind. It deranges, troubles, and perplexes thought, and so puts it out of order. Through this excitement of thought, fear brings about inflammation. It is of no use then to resort to opiates, etherization, or to hypodermic injections of morphine in order to calm down such excitement. None of these can replace the peace and calm of love. They cannot bring a disordered mind back to the natural order of spirit. It is fear that has to be cast out. Having dealt with fear, we come to the next three subjects, which fall under the main tone of truth and spirit, that which tackles ignorance as the procuring cause of sickness. This specific claim is handled through the intelligence of truth, which destroys ignorance and its resulting disease. Truth, Christ, is here shown as that which affirms all that is true, and as that which has an alterative effect upon error by overcoming and destroying disease. Now truth is spirit, hence it is infinitely reflected. And the text here has to do with the necessity of knowing the truth, pleading the truth, speaking the truth to every form of error, of mortal mind having to be instructed by truth, and so on. Here, ignorance has to give place to a knowledge of truth, to a knowledge of the truth about God, man, and the universe, so that truth is reflected in everything. Thus, we come to the third subject, where we find that truth's ordered reflection enforces translation, soul. We immediately get a sense of the dynamics of the Christ. This translation, we see, takes place through the control mind exercises over the body. Here is a tremendous sense of the greater controlling the lesser. That if we resurrect thought to the contemplation of truth, this will rule the situation. Soul's great capacity prevents anything falling out of spiritual order. Under this rule, all the many phases of error, like animal magnetism, moral and physical beliefs, lurking error, and so on, cannot bring about deflection of being. Such as crisis, disturbances, fermentation, and the like. As this subject shows, they cannot shift the balance of being in any way, and so cannot mar the reflection of truth. The rule of soul here translates the deflections of ignorance into the reflection of truth. The fourth subject teaches that truth's ordered reflection is foundational and operates through system, principle. In Christian Science practice, the only standpoint is that of principle and science. Principle is reflected in every part of the system, and so not only establishes and maintains order in the spiritual, but in the material system as well. Here, the Christ, truth, which rests on principle, stirs up any unscientific, ignorant outlook and restores the ordered economy of being. In the fifth subject, we learn that truth's ordered reflection leads to immortality and eternal life, free from heredity, birth, and death, life. We have here the wonderful sense that life is reflected in infinite life. This truth in turn reflects itself in the destruction of all the claims which try to rob eternal life, such as heredity, consumption, the belief in incurability, material birth, and death, and so on. Knowing the truth invigorates, sustains, vitalizes, and strengthens existence. At this point, the main tone changes to that of life and spirit, which extends over three subjects. It is now brought out that life is real, and that life is reflected in understanding. Furthermore, an understanding of God as the only life is shown to deal with sin as the cause of death. Usually, sin is handled through soul, but here it is not a question of dealing with sin as such. Sin is here considered as that which brings death, and therefore it is handled through life. The text now centers around Mrs. Eddy's statement. Sin brought death, and death will disappear with the disappearance of sin. Science and Health, 4:26-28-29. Sin is disbelief in God, and this brings death, while understanding God is life eternal. The Bible quotation, "If a man keep my saying, he shall never see death," is repeated here on several occasions. So the remedy for sin as the cause of death is to have spiritual understanding. This brings us to the sixth subject, which continues the preceding tone of life and shows us that understanding life is eternal being, life. Here we learn that understanding life is the substance of all being, that life is never contingent on matter. We see that by consecrating life to the everlasting Father, thus giving up the belief in material existence, we admit man's immortal status. Mrs. Eddy makes the statement here that man is, not shall be, immortal. Then there is the seventh subject, which comprises the court case. My epitome for it is that understanding life maintains the standard of manhood as perfect health, truth. This subject is really marvelous. It has a wonderful structure, but it is rather long, and since I have to confine myself to the main lines only, I would recommend you to ponder it with the help of Mr. Dorley's book, Christian Science Practice. Mrs. Eddy takes a healing of liver disease to illustrate a general law of practice. What she shows is that, if a man keep my saying, he shall never see death. In other words, if a man understands the word of life, he inherits life and is not subject to death. It shows that the real man can never sin and can therefore never be penalized with disease and death, since what sins is not man. The transgression of so-called material laws, health laws, human laws, is construed as sin, while sin is really a disbelief in God. What maintains the standard of manhood as perfect health is always to regard life from the standpoint of spiritual laws. The argument of the court of error which resides in mortal consciousness is to subject man to so-called health laws, mistakenly termed laws of nature. The disobedience of these laws is regarded as sin, which again, according to these laws, must bring disease, and disease, death. However, man is subject to the court of spirit only. The laws of which are supreme and supersede every false law. Mrs. Eddy shows here how the spirit of life intervenes as the Christ truth, as the friend of mortal man, delivering him from the so-called laws of error. What I like especially in this court case is that in the court of spirit, there is no evidence of disease, that disease was never there. Disease is never a part of man. Man's health is eternally maintained in the divine order of life. Have you ever thought how absurd it is to say that man is sick, when man is really but another term for wholeness or health? Thus we arrive at the last subject, which conveys to me the sense that understanding life is the perfect answer to every condition, love. Here Mrs. Eddy brings in a very warm and comforting sense by showing that love meets every situation with the perfect provision, that love uses both temporary and eternal means in establishing the ideal and spiritual state of being. Thus, we see that understanding life holds the solution to every problem. This concludes the fourth part. As we have seen, it depicts the reflection, spirit of love, truth, and life, and it deals with the procuring cause of all deflections of being, namely, the triad of fear, ignorance, and sin. First of all, love and spirit. Love fulfilled in its own infinite reflection deal with fear as the cause of disease. They deal with it through mental and spiritual science to free thought from fear, mind, and operate through the real and ordered, calming fear, which otherwise would excite and derange the body, spirit. Then truth and spirit, truth's ordered reflection, the truth reflected in everything, destroy ignorance as the cause of disease by enforcing translation, soul, which reaches every part of the system with its power of demonstration, principle, and frees from heredity, birth, and death, bringing out newness of life, life. Finally, we come to life and spirit, life reflected in an understanding of God, which supersede sin, disbelief in God as a procuring cause of death. This understanding of life is the substance of all being, life. It maintains the standard of manhood, truth, and it lovingly provides the solution adapted to every condition, love. So disease is healed through handling its procuring cause. Love's reflection abates fear. Truth's reflection destroys ignorance. And life's reflection supersedes sin with understanding. How far have we come? This has been a fairly long chapter, and we must be careful not to lose the main thread. We started from the first part, love and mind, love's attitude, love's contemplation of its own perfect idea. This led us to the second part, truth and mind, where we saw that this vision is the healing power of truth, is the Christ to a situation. Then we reached the third part, life and soul, where we realize that no matter what the situation may look like to the physical senses, the facts of being are unalterable. Being is anyway. Finally, we took the last step into the fourth part, where we rested in the knowledge that this love's attitude, this truth healing, and this unchangeable being are universally reflected in a fearless attitude, in a healthful knowledge, and in an understanding of being. Mrs. Eddy always laid great stress on the fact that she discovered a practical Christianity as science. The 12th chapter of her textbook explains practical Christianity as science. What we must never forget, however, is that it takes 11 chapters or fundamental spiritual steps to reach this point. So when the 12th chapter, the chapter for the practitioner, starts with love's vision of perfection, it means that it starts with a full vision, a vision which includes the living substance of the previous 11 chapters. In other words, we become only a Christianly scientific practitioner, insofar as we have lived, and I say lived, not just read through or thought through all the foregoing chapters. Practice is life. Practice is not a profession. Practice has to do with working out the way of life. So unless we live through the first 11 chapters, our practice is not really Christian Science practice. At best, it may be sympathetic influence, or benevolent hypnotism, or only a flood of stereotyped arguments. Whatever it is certainly not what Mrs. Eddy meant by Christian Science practice. Our practice must be a spiritual practice, not a mental practice with all its shortcomings. And only a spiritual practice is truly Christian. This is a point which cannot be stressed enough. Summary of the Christianity chapters. Thus, we have reached the end of the Christianity chapters, the chapters dealing with the realm of ideas. What these chapters present is Christianity in its fourfold reflection as the Word, Christ, Christianity and science. They deal with the demonstration of Christianity as the annihilation of invisible and visible error through the establishment of the realm of spiritual ideas. With the chapter creation, a definite change from the Christ to Christianity takes place, as you remember. Creation gives a statement of what constitutes creation, or the true universe. This chapter shows creation to be of the nature of idea, and that in order to grasp this ideational universe, all the limitations, all mental swaddling clothes have to be discarded. Hence, in stating the universe of ideas and giving us the way to it, the standpoint of the chapter is definitely that of Christianity reflecting the Word. In the following chapter, Science of Being, this universe of ideas is viewed in its Christ office as the dynamics of ideas. The chapter shows that an idea has the power to dispel invisible error and visible error, and that it operates as a divine infinite calculus. The standpoint there is typically Christianity reflecting the Christ. The next chapter, Some Objections Answers, takes us a step further and illustrates that this universe of ideas consists of infinite relationships of ideas which form one coherent whole. The chapter makes plain that every idea is not only one with principle, but is one with all other ideas. This infinite reflection depicts the standpoint of Christianity reflecting Christianity. Then, Christian Science practice deals with the conscious application of this realm of ideas. It explains how a knowledge of the nature of ideas, the dynamics of ideas, and the coherency of ideas can be scientifically used to solve everyday problems. There we have the standpoint of Christianity reflecting science. Having attained this point, we could ask ourselves, well, what else do we need? And what more can we ask for? Should we not be satisfied when we arrive here? I think many people would be and would like to hold here. Yet, we must go on. And only if we go further can we reach the heart of divine science. What is this further step? In Christian Science practice, we came to the point where we were taught how to use ideas scientifically. But, after all, can we use an idea? An idea is always God's idea. Principle and idea is one. And with the dawning of this realization, thought is now led on to an even higher plane, to the plane of science, where principle is understood through its idea, where principle expresses itself as idea, where principle includes its idea, and where principle always operates as idea. This is what the next four chapters, the chapters on science, will explain to us in more detail. Teaching Christian Science. The last chapter showed us how to be practitioners, how to apply consciously the realm of ideas in human experience in order to correct disharmony. However, the main purpose of Christian Science is not primarily to heal, but to be whole and to remain whole, not to correct disharmony, but to stay harmonious in every way. This is what Mrs. Eddy indicates in her last paragraph in Christian Science Practice when she says, "Christian Scientists, be a law to yourselves that mental malpractice cannot harm you, either when asleep or when awake." Science and Health, 442, 30-32. She tells us to be a law to ourselves, or in other words, not merely to use laws, but far more to embody law, to be law-abiding, law-obedient, law-disciplined, and law-expressing. In fact, to be the idea of science. This exhortation heralds the chapter, Teaching Christian Science. This chapter does not expound the teaching of Christian Science. That will be done in recapitulation. Teaching Christian Science means here, teach yourself to be a scientist. Throughout this chapter, we are taught to train ourselves into knowing ourselves only as principle's idea. We are taught how to be in conformity with principle, how to be the idea of science, how to be scientifically one with God. The standpoint of the chapter is therefore that of science reflecting the Word. The chapter teaches the unity of principle and idea and how, through a complete impersonalization, we recognize ourselves to be the idea of science. To be impersonal, that is, to be in conformity with principle, rests on a very high sense of ethics. When we read this chapter, we cannot help noticing how Mrs. Eddy keeps referring to this sense of ethics and morals. In ordinary language, ethics is defined as a system of moral principles, and here in Christian Science, ethics is shown to be adherence to principle. Adherence to principle is the embodiment of principle's idea. The moment we adhere to principle, we are no more our personal self, but a scientific idea, a scientist. I like what Mrs. Eddy understands by ethics in this chapter, that all is mind, and that the scientist must conform to God's requirements. Science and Health, 4:4:4:32-1. Ethics means conformity with the allness of God, where the only I, or person, is the divine principle. This constant falling into line with principle is brought out in the chapter through the oft-recurring phrases indicating the sense of adhering strictly to principle and abiding strictly by principle. In this way, Mrs. Eddy stresses again and again that the ethics of Christian Science lies in adhering strictly to the divine principle and the rules of divine metaphysics, and in abiding by them. Thus, it is not enough to adhere to principle, we must also abide by it. It is most interesting that the term strict occurs noticeably often in this chapter, which points out the severe trait of ethics. The sense of conforming to principle is brought out very strongly, too, and with it we also have the requirement of living and doing right. So all through we have that high ethical sense of complying with science. This sense of scientific ethics runs right through the chapter and culminates in the paramount statement ending it. Neither dishonesty nor ignorance ever founded, nor can they overthrow a scientific system of ethics. Science and Health 464, 27-29. If you compare this statement with the last statement of the previous chapter, you will catch the message of teaching Christian Science. Mrs. Eddy urges us at the end of Christian Science Practice to be a law to ourselves. Then the chapter teaching Christian Science instructs us through a scientific system of ethics how to be a law to ourselves, and finally leaves us with a sense that through being a law to ourselves, we can rest in the assurance that nothing, neither malpractice nor ignorance, can harm us, can overthrow a scientific system of ethics.